Well, let me thank you all for coming. And I want to challenge you with a thought. And today I want to talk to you about sowing and reaping. And an experience that probably all of us have had at one time or another in our life. And that is sowing what we thought was good seed, but then we didn't reap what we thought we were going to reap. Does everybody relate to that? Sometimes it shows up in being persecuted for nothing. You did really nothing wrong, and yet you are the object of persecution or abuse, or you are the one that people blame. Well, that's what happened to a man by the name of Henry. And Henry was born in 1855. He was born to a fairly wealthy family, and he grew up, enjoyed his childhood until he was 9 years old. At 9 years old, his father died. That was a tragedy in Henry's life because Henry was very, very attached to his father. The next day after the funeral, he went to see the preacher. He was searching for answers. Why is it that my father had to die when I was nine? And so the preacher shared with him the gospel of Jesus Christ, and Henry became a Christian. Henry then grew in the Lord and had an occasion about 5 or 6 years later to hear the famous evangelist D.L. Moody. And D.L. Moody was a fiery man. He was an ex-businessman turned preacher. That's always a dangerous thing when business guys turn to be preachers. But that's what he was. He was a very passionate man. And he said in his sermon that particular night that God has not seen a man who has fully consecrated himself to the Lord. Because if the world had seen that, it would be incredible what would be done. Henry was so impressed by that comment. He spent about an hour walking by the lake. He lived in Cleveland, and that which is on a borders the Great Lakes there. So he spent about an hour walking down the lake, thinking and pondering and determining in his heart that he was going to be that man that was fully consecrated to God. And he was going to walk out his life that way. Henry then, about 2 years later, he went to an Eastern school, which was his father's intent. And his father had set up a trust and funded it with $27,000 for him to get his Eastern education. Now, $27,000 back then is about $270,000 today. So it's a substantial sum of money to go to school. But after Henry had spent 1 year in school, he came home and he discovered he was sick. He was sick with the very disease that had killed his father. His father died of tuberculosis. During those days, they didn't know how to cure TB. So the only thing the doctors knew to tell him was, you need to go live in a warm climate. Cleveland is not the place for you to live and try to deal with this disease. And there was enough medical research that lent some encouragement to Henry that if he did that, maybe he could lick the disease. So he went out west for 6 years. And before he left, he spent probably a year in bed. And during that year in bed, he didn't do what you and I do. You and I, when we're in bed, we turn on the TV. Well, he read his Bible. For a year, he read his Bible. And he meditated on the Bible. Can you imagine that, having nothing to do, laying in bed all day long and just reading the Bible, praying and meditating on what you're reading? Well, in the course of all that, Henry was really touched by what he was reading, and he was convinced that God was going to heal him. He really was convinced that God had a plan and a purpose for his life, and that God was going to take him through this process of healing, and that was going to be part of the road to find his destiny. So he went out west. He spent 7 years out there, and by the way, before he went, he had it in his heart, he was convinced that that's how long it would take. Well, at the end of 7 years, he was healthy and able to re-engage. He came back, and by that time, Henry had had some experience with business, because when he went out to California and Colorado and just spent all those years out there, he got bored just doing nothing. And so he wound up doing some business activities, and he discovered he was pretty good at it. He actually started and sold some businesses and realized he had a knack for this. So when he came back to Cleveland, his uncle had acquired a dilapidated oatmeal. And this oatmeal was just falling apart. The industry was bad. The market was bad. So Henry spent about 6 months or so looking at it, doing his due diligence. Finally concluded that he, in prayer and through his due diligence, he was supposed to buy this failing company. So we went ahead and bought this company. And he and his friend, Jim Andrews, start working this company. Now, it didn't take Henry long to realize he really had a challenge on his hands. Because back then, oatmeal was not regarded as a good food. Oats were regarded as horse food. Okay? So He had the challenge of getting the consumers to see things differently. Furthermore, he had a small company, and though he had some capital left from the trust that his dad had given him, he hadn't used it all in his 7 years of convalescing and healing. He still had some capital, but he didn't have enough to really change the impression of the consumers about oatmeal. So he decided, the thing I need to do is I need to go around and get my fellow competitors, and we need to form an association, and we need to have a common brand, we need to have common pricing, we need to have common quality, and we need to look all the same. So it looks like there's a big old company when it's a bunch of little bitty millers working together in association. And he pitched this to his competitors, and they liked it. And so they formed the association in Cleveland, Ohio in 1887. Now, it's interesting that as they formed this association, the one person that didn't join was the biggest miller in Cleveland. In fact, he was in Akron. He was a man by the name of Schumacher. Schumacher was an old German who was about a generation older than Henry. And Schumacher's attitude was, you know, the old ways will work. We don't need any new ways. And the way they sold oatmeal back then was they would sell barrels to the general store. And the general store basically would stick the barrel out in the middle and it would just be open. And you can imagine all the vermin and insects and everything that got into the barrel. And so every time you went to buy some oatmeal, you had to deal with the insects. Now, Henry looked at that and said, you know, there's got to be a better way. So he came up with little 2-pound packages that were vermin-proof. And they were colorful. So Henry thought this was the way to go. Now, Schumacher, the German, he didn't see any reason to do that. Furthermore, Henry was really, really convinced we've got to advertise. We have got to convince the homemaker that oatmeal is a good, nutritious product. It's economical. It's the way they ought to be serving breakfast in the morning. So he was determined to use a lot of advertising to do that. Schumacher thought advertising was a waste and thought all these boxes were a waste. Just sell it in barrels like we've always done. Furthermore, Henry realized that the sales should not be to the storekeeper. It should be to the consumer. Where Schumacher was said, let's just send our salesmen to the storekeepers and try to cram as many barrels of oatmeal down their throat as we can. That was his philosophy. So we had a totally two different philosophies in these two men. So it's not surprising that Schumacher decided he didn't want to be part of this association. Well, in March of 1886, something happened. Schumacher's mill burned down. His mill and all the surrounding buildings. So suddenly Schumacher is out of business. Well, Henry is a very gracious man. He's a believer, and he believes in being kind and gracious to people, despite the fact that Schumacher has not been gracious to him at all. In fact, in all of their dealings, Schumacher has been disdaining and been critical and unkind. And there's no reason for Henry to think he should go and spend any time or extend an olive branch to Schumacher, but he did. Because he felt sorry for Schumacher. He felt sorry for the plight he was in now, having lost all of his buildings. So Henry goes over to meet him, and he expresses his condolences, and he discovers that Schumacher has no insurance, that he had not taken out insurance on his facility because the premium was too high. So Henry, in his kindness, says, would you like to join the association? And Schumacher saw an opportunity. Suddenly, it's a different story now. You know, his mill is in ashes. You know, he doesn't have the business he used to have. Maybe he can gain control of this association and he can rebuild his empire. So he began to negotiate with Henry and the others of the association. Unbeknownst to Henry and the others, he also made a deal to buy a mill in the adjacent community. This mill happened to have very little business, but what it did have was the latest technology, the latest production technology. So what was going on here was the way the association divided up or allocated up the sales was based on production capability. So by the time that he joined the association, he had acquired this other company, he brought all this massive production capability to the table. And so he wound up with a lot more influence than was intended. Initially, he was kind of equal footing with Henry. Well, as time goes by, the association begins to evolve. I guess all of you have had experiences where things don't quite work out as you hoped. You start out with one dream or vision about how things are going to happen. It doesn't quite work. So now you've got to adjust. So they reorganized the association in 1888, I believe it was. And some of the smaller millers fell out, and so now we have Schumacher and Henry basically running this association again. And in 1891, Henry came up with the idea, let's all merge all of our assets together into one company. And everybody agreed to do that, including Schumacher. But Schumacher, being the shrewd German that he was, he negotiated very hard for the value of his stock. So as it turned out, when all the smoke cleared, he had 50% of the new company, which gave him control. So immediately he demoted Henry and Henry's right-hand man, Robert. So Schumacher took control of the company. Now, Schumacher was still determined to get rid of Henry because Schumacher hated Henry, hated Henry's ideas and thoughts, hated his progressive attitude. So what was he going to do? He needed an opportunity. So what happened is he waited and bid his time. He knew that he couldn't just dump Henry because everybody respected Henry, loved Henry, knew Henry was critical to the health of the company. So 5 years later, the company has a bad quarter. That provided the opening for him. The first thing he did is he took Henry's right-hand man, Robert, who was the CFO, he got the board to agree to fire Robert. We had a bad quarter. We didn't expect it. Robert didn't tell us it was coming. He wasn't prepared for it. We got a cash flow problem. Get rid of the controller. Okay? The board bought into it. And so he was able to fire Robert. So suddenly Henry is operating by himself without his trusted companion. And it was just a matter of time before Schumacher was able to get enough support to oust Henry. So in 1897, after all this hard work of building this company, Henry is out on the streets, fired by the German Schumacher, who had done nothing but show disdain, despite the fact that Henry had been so gracious, sown great seeds of kindness and sympathy and mercy when Schumacher was down in the dumps. And Schumacher had reciprocated with unkindness, ingratitude, vengeance, and ultimately terminated him. So the question that you've got to answer around your roundtable discussions is this. If you were Henry, what would you do? Henry was a very deep man of God. He was a prayer warrior. He prayed every day for his business. But he was also a student of Scripture. In fact, when he would go to work, toward the latter part of his life, he would ride the train. He lived in Chicago. That's where the company was during those days. And when he got on the train, everybody else is on the train reading the newspaper and all that, and he's pulling out his Bible. So he used his train time every day to read his Bible. And that was his practice all of his life. So when the day that Henry was fired and he went home, he got on his knees and began to pray. Henry was convinced when he went into this business in 1882 at 27 years old, he was convinced that God called him to that business. Not just that God called him to business, but God called him to that business. And to buy that company, that sick oatmeal company that was floundering and losing money, he was called to turn that business around. And he did it, and he did it very well over the next 15 years. Did an incredible job of turning this business into a very profitable enterprise. So he was convinced that he was supposed to be part of the company, that he was not supposed to go start another company. Furthermore, his character would not have let him start on a character assassination campaign, nor would it allow him to sue Schumacher. So he drops on his knees and he says, "Lord, what do I do?" And yes, he had accountability partners, Wayne. His friend Robert, who had been fired a few months earlier, became his accountability partner, and they began to pray together, and they began to ask the Lord, "What do we do?" For a year they prayed. A year they talked, and they looked for every ethical, legal way they could to try to get back in control of the company. They were unwilling to do anything unethical. It had to be ethical. The only thing they came up with is they felt we're supposed to buy whatever stock is available in the market. Henry had 12% of the company. Robert had 12% of the company. Schumacher had 50% of the company. So there was 26% of the company in other hands. So they began to let it be known to some of the shareholders they would be willing to buy. Now, they didn't have a lot of hopes that this was going to go anywhere. So even the best case scenario, they wind up with 50% of the stock and Schumacher has 50% of the stock. You just got a stalemate. That doesn't solve anything. So they didn't see where this was going to go, but they just felt the Lord telling them, buy the stock. At the same time, unbeknownst to them, Schumacher had put some new people on the board. And one of the people he put on the board was a man by the name of Will Christie. Will Christie was a banker. And Schumacher was very interested in elevating his perspective among bankers. So he thought one of the ways to do it is put Will Christie on there and let Will Christie tell the banking world how great Schumacher is. So Will Christie came on the board. He had no idea what was going on or what was happening with this company. But as he began to sit in board meetings and observe, he began to realize that Schumacher was inept, that he did not have the skill to run this company. And then he began to look at the success of this company, and he realized there were three men that had made this happen. First was Henry and his marketing skill. Secondly was Robert and his financial skill. And thirdly was the production manager by the name of Jim Andrews. Jim Andrews had done a marvelous job of integrating the latest production technology into the plant, making it a very efficient operation. Henry had done an incredible job of marketing and packaging and advertising to make the brand so widely known and make the sales soar. And Robert had done a masterful job with the finances. These are the three men that had made the company what it was, and now they're all three gone. And as Will Christie looked at the company and saw Schumacher bringing in his family and his cronies who were not qualified to do this, and he watched the company begin to spiral down, he realized he could not stand by and let this happen, despite the fact that he was supposedly a friend of Schumacher's. And Schumacher had brought him on thinking that this was going to be a friendly board member. Well, Will Christie got convicted that he had to do something. So he went to some friends, some investors, and he laid out this company and laid out what Henry and his associates had done to build this company and said, look, if we can get Henry and Robert and Jim back running this company again, we will have a dynamic company that will make lots of money and can take us into the 20th century in a way that will just be blessings for everybody involved. Schumacher is out of date. He doesn't know what's going on. Furthermore, he's not serving the interest of the shareholders. He's serving his own personal agenda. So Will convinced these investors that they could get control of the company and make these changes and turn this to a very profitable investment. Schumacher has no idea this is going on, and nor does Henry. Henry and Robert are just buying whatever stock they can. In the meantime, they noticed other people are buying stock. Well, Schumacher noticed it also, because what happened is the price of the stock went from 40 to 90. Okay, in about a month or so. And the reason it did is because you got all these buyers now trying to buy the stock. Well, Schumacher thinks it's his investor friends of Will Christie who are loyal to him that are buying the stock. So he says, you know, I've got some debt I need to clean up. I think I'll sell a little stock and clean it up. So he sells about 10% of his interest. So now he has 40% of the company. The next board meeting, Schumacher had a reality check. He discovered Will Christie's agenda as he was ousted as president of the company, and Henry and Robert were reinstated. Now, the moral to this story is this. Business is far more than what we see. It's far more than what we can perceive of in the natural. God is doing things that we don't even begin to understand. There's no way Henry could have orchestrated these events. Henry tried every way he possibly could to try to get back in control legally and ethically, could not come up with a way to do it. But God had a masterful way to do it, because that's the way he works. He's the master at orchestrating events and circumstances. What Henry did was he was on his knees in prayer with friends, seeking God, asking the question, Lord, what do you want to do? He was going through what I call the divine process for finding answers to any question. It's called knock, seek, ask. And Scripture says, when you knock, he will answer the door. When you seek, you will find. When you ask, he will respond to you. He's the consummate Father, so when we ask for bread, he will not give us a snake. So as Henry asked for God's will, what do you want to do? What do you want to, I feel you have given me this stewardship of this company. It's been taken away from me by a man who has double-crossed me, who's betrayed me, who's treated me with disdain, despite the fact I've sown such great seeds of love and compassion and sensitivity and helped this man in the depths of his despair, he's come back and attacked me and removed me from my own company. Lord, what do you want to do? He allowed vengeance to be the Lord. He did not take on the role of being the tool of vengeance. And so that's how God wants us to operate. Every one of us has got situations where we have been unjustly crucified. Okay? Now, there are situations where we've been justly crucified. Okay? We've all got those. But there are situations where, you know, we got something, well, we didn't really sow that seed. It looked like we got something, we didn't sow the seed. The reality is God's doing something if we let Him do it. If we can trust Him to work circumstances and to orchestrate His will and stand back and just be on our knees and be in the Word and be people of prayer and faith, we might just be amazed at what God would do. That's what Henry did, because he learned early on to be a man of faith. He walked that way all of his life. And some of you may know a little bit about Henry. His name was Henry Parsons Crowell. His company is the Quaker Oaks Company. And single-handedly, Henry Parsons Crowell did something that probably none of you know about. Some of you may have guessed that he was Quaker Oaks. But you probably don't know this, that single-handedly he saved Moody Bible Institute. Dwight L. Moody died in 1899, and Dwight L. Moody was not a strategist. They did not have a strategic plan. Apparently they didn't find me, or they didn't call me to come help them. Okay? Okay? Or I would have helped them with that strategic plan. But they did not have a strategic plan. So when Dwight L. Moody died, and the oversight of the presidency of the institution was turned over to R.A. Torrey, who was a great preacher and a great theologian, but not an administrator, not a business person. The institution was falling apart from lack of leadership, lack of planning, lack of capital. Henry Parsons Crowell came in single-handedly and put the plan in place to save the institution, and even put a lot of his own money into it to make it happen. It exists today because of Henry Parsons Crowell. Okay. And Moody Bible Institute, if you go online and take a look at it, it's interesting. There's almost no recognition of him today, which is sad because he has done a tremendous thing. But he did more than that. In the 1920s, he had made lots of money, and he was determined to leave his mark. The mark he wanted to leave was not for himself, but it was for Christ. He wanted to leave a mark that would last for generations to come. And he knew there was a lot of liberal thinking coming into the church and into theological institutions. So he set up a trust. And that trust exists today. It's called the Henry Parsons and Susan Coleman Crowell Trust. That trust has very strict requirements. The trustees of that trust have to pass very rigid tests and are submitted to each other every year. If any of the trustees fails to pass this very rigid test of conservative biblical theology, they're eliminated automatically by the trust agreement. In fact, personally, I've never seen a trust like this. It's phenomenal. And so now, almost 80 years later, that trust is still faithful to the mission that Henry Crowell set it up for. And it gives away about $5 million a year to evangelical Christian causes. Now, where did Henry Crowell get that? Well, he got that from his father. His father passed that seed on to him when he set up a trust for Henry as a young man to educate him. And so Henry's father now is touching us today with the money that's coming from that trust. You see, Henry saw things a lot bigger than we do. And he knew God was orchestrating the events, and he knew he was called of God to do what he did. And he was going to walk out that calling even if he couldn't see how to do it, because he knew God had a plan. And so he was always willing to submit to God in prayer and trust that God would guide and direct. Can we be people like that? Can we learn that we don't have to be in control? That we don't have to have all the answers? That if we can trust, if we sow good seeds of faithfulness and truth and righteousness and prayer, that God will work out His will in a way that will be marvelous and will be amazing to us? Can we trust that? It's real hard for us business types, because we want to see everything. We want to control everything. We want to be able to predict how things are going to happen. But Henry Crowell was content in not being able to control things and not seeing everything and not being able to predict. He was content in trusting God to do all of that. What he did every day was he got up and he sought the Lord in prayer and in the scriptures. And that's how he walked every day. The last day of his life, he left his office in the afternoon. This is the year 1943. It's October of 1943. And he took the train to and from work. And he walked to the train station. He was a little late, so he walked briskly. He got on the train. He sat down. And as was his custom, he pulls out his Bible. He carried a New Testament, opens it up, and he slumps over dead. 3 days later, when he was buried, that very Bible was in his hand in the casket. And it was an incredible eulogy to this man of God that walked by faith all of his life, given that day. Now, you and I can be like Henry Parsons Crowell. We can do that. Simple. All we got to do is choose to walk by faith in everything we do, including work. Be people of prayer, people of the Scriptures, people of the Holy Spirit, people of destiny. Know that God's called us. Find our place and stay in our place. Don't abandon the ship because the going gets rough or you can't see how it's going to work. Stay where God called you. Do what you're called to do. And you can be the man of faith.